5 days later, they were marching through Rome Airport. The lovely woman at Cook's travel agency had suggested they take a flight on account of the flood-damaged railway system, and then a bus to Florence. "Bus?" said Dotty, as if she'd never been on one. She hadn't. Dotty was dressed for a month at sea, but Evelyn was definitely dressed for mud. She was wearing galoshes and a riding mack that had seen better days and never a horse. Dotty said she smelt strongly of rubber, which was not wholly unappealing, she added. A taxi took them to the bus station, where a kind and helpful luggage porter led them to a spot of lunch in Giuseppe Verdi's, an Italian equivalent of a transport cab. It was packed, which was a good sign, with just one table available. As soon as Evelyn opened her mouth, she became an Italian again. A charm offensive opened the door of a surly waiter, behind which was a host of homemade specials, none of which were chalked on the board. Eventually, both Evelyn and Dotty agreed on the spaghetti alla carbonara, bread, and a carafe of house wine, white. Evelyn looked about and sighed. "You're home," said Dotty.
"We're home. All those years we spent with Aunt Maria."
"We were rather naughty," said Dotty.
"Do you think she knew?"
"Of course she knew. She told me as much."
"Ah, grazie," said Evelyn as the wine arrived. "Told me as much before she died. She said, 'I pray you find the right one.' She used the feminine for the right one."
"Oh, classy Maria," said Dotty, and she poured out the wine. "Here." And the women raised their glasses. "To finding Ulysses," they said. The wine was crisp and reviving, the carbonara delicious.
"Wholly authentic," said Evelyn.
"In what way?" said Dotty.
"No cream whatsoever."
"No cream? But it's so creamy."
"The creaminess," said Evelyn, "is purely yolk with the faintest hint of egg white, with the addition of cheese, both parmesan and pec—"
"I thought it was pecorino," said Dotty. "And is the bacon bacon or another sleight of hand?"
"Not bacon, my darling, but guanciale, pig jowl."
"Guanciale," repeated Dotty. "How I've missed Italy. A delicate crunch, and then your mouth floods with an oily saltiness."
"The only seasoning," said Evelyn, "is a grind, perhaps, of pepper, and the whole ensemble brought together with a soupçon of pasta water." "Well, I never."
They struggled through the terminus with their luggage until a young American woman brought help their way. In the queue to board, Dotty said, "Well, this is an adventure." And the young woman said, "Have you not been to Florence before, Miss Cunningham?" And Evelyn said,
"She's talking about going on a bus."
A quarter of an hour later, Dotty said, "Never again." The bus hadn't even left Rome. They pulled into Santa Maria Novella rail station just before the 5 o'clock bells rang out, and dusk was a solid accompaniment. Evelyn and Dotty climbed down the steps and collected their luggage. The smell of diesel and sewage cut through the air and set a somber tone to this encounter.
"Oh, my," said Evelyn. "What's happened to you, Firenze, amore mio?"
"There's a medieval feeling in the air," said Dotty.
"Brutal, violent, and yes, suspicious."
They moved carefully down the incline into a bleak square lit glaringly by arc lights. They said goodbye to the young American woman and watched as she almost came a cropper on the oil. "I don't fancy our chances on that stuff," said Dotty. And by a stroke of luck, one of the only remaining taxis that had a special permit to enter the city happened to pass at that moment. Dotty raised her hand.
"Oh, well spotted," said Evelyn.
She gave the address, and they clambered in. The taxi took the long way round to the river due to the unpassable nature of many roads. No street lights, no neon advertising. Only the sweep of headlights caught the undulating wave of destruction. An occasional lit brazier, around which soldiers and the homeless warmed themselves. At 5:30 p.m, Evelyn and Dotty arrived outside Pensione Pici, only noticing then that the guest house had been built on a slightly elevated part of the Lungarno, which had ultimately spared it. Enzo was waiting for them outside, holding a kerosene lamp.
"My dear Enzo, you got the telegram," said Evelyn,
and Enzo said it was the highlight of his week.
You're my only guests, he said in his gruff Florentine accent.
He took their luggage and led them inside. As they climbed the stairs, he explained the small miracles that had happened every day, the progress the city had made. Electricity and running water had now been restored, and although dinner will be a little basic,
I will not let you starve, he said. And how are the people coping? Said Evelyn.
One more flight of stairs to go.
Ah, the people. A deep sigh. Resilient and suffering. Thousands of businesses in ruin, thousands of families living in barracks, 20,000 on the relief roll. But we keep going, we always have. We keep cleaning, and when we remember to, we keep singing. And one day we will triumph once more. Here we are, he said. Your room, signore, just as you left it.
Inside, a small electric heater in the corner glowed orange. Enzo placed the cases on racks. One last thing, he said, and he disappeared. 5 minutes later, he knocked on the door and handed Evelyn a bottle of perfectly chilled spumante.
Because I know you have a choice, he said.
When he closed the door, Dottie threw herself on the bed, inconsolable.
These people, Linny. I know, my darling.
The next morning, the two women set out carefully under a low grey sky. Although the worst of the debris had been dragged away, into the river by the looks of things, said Dottie, a new wave of mud and oil had appeared after the cellars were pumped clean. The city, once again, sat under a thick brown layer of precarious, stinking rot. Red Cross tents had sprung up in squares, and trestle tables and benches too. Braziers and the wail of the ambulances or the fire service were a constant reckoning. Along the Arno, the embankments and parapets were being rebuilt, and the earth shook with the rumble of tractors and diggers. Away from the river, shops had begun to reappear, albeit timidly and with little stock. A fruttivendolo sold them clementines and pears. They stopped at a cafe that had only reopened that morning, and the owner showed them the waterline, 6 feet. He sat them beneath it ominously and brought them cappuccini and pastries, and Evelyn had a glance at La Nazione.
13,000 artworks, injured or lost. No hope at all for the Cimabue crucifix. Millions of books still under mud. Oh. And my dear Church of San Firenze has suffered terribly, she said. Anything good at all? Said Dottie.
Evelyn scanned the pages.
Oh, yes, here's something. Masaccio frescoes in Capelle Brancacci unharmed. Giotto's frescoes in Santa Croce also safe for now, although the water's coming up through the walls and the salt is threatening to unseat the paint. Do you think we might head over there, Dottie?
If we take it slow, I think we might just have a chance, Dottie replied. It took them 2 hours to get to Santa Croce, trying mostly to walk in tracks laid down by cars or other people's feet. Evelyn especially was exhausted by the effort. Her heart was dealt a double blow at the sight of narrow streets still full of water and unstable building fronts held up by timber scaffold. When they got to the square, apart from the removal of cars, it seemed little headway had been made in 14 days. The square was still a rotten bog.
Only the flood of 1333 could be compared to this tragedy, she said.
She stood back as a bulldozer rolled past. She leant against the wall and wondered what on earth she was doing. What use was this 86-year-old woman in a city that needed energy and strong arms and, yes, good balance?
You silly, silly woman. Chin up, Linny, said Dottie, as if reading her thoughts. Still early days.
And they turned back, Dottie leading the way to the Uffizi. Outside in the piazza, sprawled on the ground, were dozens of young people caked in mud. Some wore beads, all had tired, glazed eyes and faces streaked with dirt. Evelyn lit up at the sight of them. Long-haired, short-haired, beards, hippies, women in skirts or shorts or trousers, an air of soporific exhaustion and a little love, warmed by a brazier, passing bottles of wine donated by a grateful Florentine, and the songs of the Beatles, Beach Boys, Bob and Baez, tripping out from a frail transistor radio that had seen better, cleaner days. "Most of the men look like Allen Ginsberg," said Dotty.
"They're the future," she said.
"God help us," said Dotty. But those students who were studying art recognised Dotty immediately and made room for her and Evelyn at a makeshift dining table. The women shared their clementines and pears, and the students shared their wine. A young woman asked if they were there to help with the restoration, and Dotty said, "Oh, yes, and also for this," and she nudged Evelyn to show the newspaper photograph of Ulysses. There were many comments about the force of the water and the effort on the man's face and the beauty of the globe, but no one knew who he was or had seen him around. "Worth a try," whispered Dotty. If only they'd known that 600 metres away underground, Jem Gunnerslake was passing books to a young woman who was once called Kid but was now called Alice. But these revelations would have to wait. For now, an air of contentment hung over the scene. Days passed. Frost, mist, gloom, blue sky, sun. Evelyn showed the photograph of Ulysses to shopkeepers, passing students. She even showed it to a group of carabinieri outside the Duomo. One man thought he'd heard of a globe maker in San Frediano, and Evelyn headed there, but to no avail. That trip wore her out, and her ankle flared from overuse. She needed 2 days with her leg up at the pensione. "We're so close, I can feel it," said Dotty, jollying her along. But Evelyn wasn't so sure. She slept a lot, which wasn't like her at all. International funds started to pour into the city to rescue the damaged art, and Dotty got the volunteer bug and donated a piece of work to Artists for Florence. She sent a telegram to gallery owner Joyce to see if a large work entitled "It's Only Ever the Start" was still available. The return telegram revealed it was. Evelyn persuaded Dotty to do what she herself would like to have done, which was to head back to Santa Croce and make herself useful. Dotty joined a line of students into the Basilica and there recognised Mr. Hempel from the V&A, who recognised her at the same time. They'd met at a fundraiser for something or other. He was a sculpture conservator, and he put her to work immediately on the marble monuments. Layers of solvent followed by layers of talcum powder to get the oil out of the stone. Tedious to the hilt. And a day felt like a month to Dotty. But not only had she been tasked with Dante's memorial, couldn't wait to tell Evelyn, she was also working alongside a very lovely young woman from Stockholm. "Could you hold this, please, Dotty?" "I most certainly can, Inga." And then... One morning when December was within reach, when the sky was sharply blue and a brittle frost brought clarity of mind, Evelyn held on to the wall in her bedroom, stood on one leg, and put her full weight on her ankle. A little hop and no pain. She was revived.
"Onwards, my darling."
She was back in the newly reopened cafe, seated under the waterline with a double espresso. The caffeine was hammering away in her chest like a woodpecker. On the table in front of her was the picture of Ulysses. She felt something was staring her in the face, something so brutishly familiar, and yet it remained elusive. She couldn't put a finger on it. A shadow fell across the image, and she looked up at the owner. "Qui è?" the man said.
"A friend," said Evelyn, "but I don't know where he is. I know he's here in Florence somewhere, but where? That is the question."
The man picked up the newspaper clipping. After a beat, he said, "Il Palazzo di Biancacapello."
"What?" said Evelyn.
"Via Maggio, you see," he said, "just here. This corner. The pattern is so distinct."
"Oh my goodness, that's it. That's where I recognized it from. Thank you. Thank you, my dear man."
And Evelyn retied her scarf, downed her coffee, and left. She crossed over Santa Trinita Bridge, pausing momentarily to watch the engineers below clear the riverbed of its debris. The sad sight of a gutted piano hauled into the air, the death song of its strings sharply plangent. The other side now, careful to look left and right.
past Borgo San Jacopo and into Via Maggio. She slowed down, took her time to look at faces, to look into small alleyways, because she knew she was close. She stood outside Bianca Capello's palazzo and looked at the photograph, and it was no mistake that it had been taken right there, that fateful hour. A woman cleaning out her cheese shop stands next to her and points to the photograph and says, "Signor Tempa."
"Si, Signor Tempa," says Evelyn.
"Dove?" The woman points. "Santo Spirito," she says.
"Of course, Santo Spirito," thinks Evelyn.
Onwards she goes, takes a right past the basilica, and is careful across the stones, always pausing, always looking. She is so close now, she can feel it. She sees an old man scrubbing a jukebox, a large blue parrot atop a statue, and then him, cleaning a stone bench. She moves closer.
"Ulysses?" she says.
He looks up. He smiles.
"It is you, isn't it?"
she says. "Hello, Evelyn." 22 years, and where do you start? Some might say where you left off.
"So tell me, Ulysses, how is the good captain?"
And it was the silence that alerted her, that long, steady intake of breath. And around the kitchen table in an old palazzo, Ulysses told his story. First time Cress had heard some of it, and it made him a bit choked, truth be told. Darnley, Arturo, Peg, the kid called Alice, the inheritance, the move to Italy, the pensione, Dottie's portrait of Alice, a wild dash for a train.
"So that was you?" said Evelyn.
"Yes, but how do you know that was me?" Evelyn laughing now. She said,
"Dottie Cunningham saw you from the train."
"Dottie Cunningham?" said Ulysses.
"She's my oldest friend," said Evelyn. "She's here with me now."
And they couldn't believe how so many roads had either led to him or led to her. And for Evelyn, there was equal sadness as there was delight at hearing how close they'd been to one another. How touchable, if only the preciousness of time, you see. They heard the front door open. "In here, Alice," said Ulysses.
"Oh, my God," said Alice. "Hello, kid," said Evelyn.
"Miss Skinner?" said Jem.
"Jem Gunnerslake," said Evelyn.
Fair to say, there was more than a touch of farce to the reunion. 2 days later, Evelyn and Dottie moved into the guest room. It was the best room and still smelt of Des.
"Amber, isn't it?" said Evelyn.
"With a touch of citron," said Dottie.
"Expensive," they added.
Dottie and Evelyn's first night turned into a double celebration on account of tap water finally being declared drinkable in the city. That meant unlimited baths and showers, albeit in cold water. The students glistened and Pete said they smelt lovely and fresh like summer linen. He was head down at the piano, as he always was, a medley of show tunes to get the evening warmed up. Jem, Alice and Massimo sang along, and Claude performed a spot of asymmetric hovering. Dottie turned to Evelyn and said,
"I might be wrong, but do you think Pete's the man who played a frontier pianist with a drink problem all those years ago in the West End, a small but noticeable part?" "I think you're right," said Evelyn.
"I feel as if I've imbibed a hallucinogen, Linny."
"How lovely," said Evelyn.
Suddenly a knock at the door.
"I'll get it,"
shouted Ulysses.
"Not too early, am I?"
said the elderly Contessa, barging in. Ulysses had bought her an electric stove, but she'd found every conceivable thing wrong with it and ultimately shunned it in favour of food and company at the pensione. But who could blame her? "We've sat you at your usual place, Contessa," said Ulysses, "and we have two more guests."
"Two more? You giving St. Francis a run for his money?"
16 sat down for dinner that night. The wine kept flowing. Bowls of tagliatelle al tartufo kept flowing. Bread and conversation flowing. Pete telling Cress about Cole's new girlfriend, June.
"Not June Woeful?"
"That's her," said Pete.
"Won't last," said Cress.
"He needs someone older," said Ulysses.
Older than Woeful?
Older than him, said Ulysses. I always prefer someone older, said Pete.
What's he saying? Said the elderly Contessa.
Pete says he prefers an older woman, said Alice, translating.
I'm not on the market, said the elderly Contessa.
Massimo talking to Jem about Ernest Hemingway, and Dottie said she'd met him in a bar once.
Kept going on about a six-word story, she said. Such a bore, so male.
Jem said his mother still talked so fondly of the weekend Dottie taught her to paint.
Ah, the divine Penelope, said Dottie.
Do you think she might enjoy a follow-up?
Incorrigible, whispered Evelyn.
A knife tapped against a spoon. The conversation hushed, and Ulysses stood up. He delivered an invocation of thanks, mostly, that they were all gathered at that moment in time. How that meant something, would continue to mean something over the years. True worth, he said. So there they were, young and old, and some in the middle. Shadows and candlelight, freeze-framed with glasses raised. To this moment, he said, looking at Evelyn. She smiled. To this moment, they all said. At the approach of Christmas, the students began to depart. Jem was on his way to the station with Alice when he caught sight of Massimo on the concourse. Massimo wasn't there to say goodbye, but to persuade Jem to stay. Till term restarted, that's all. Not much persuasion needed. Jem thought Massimo handsome and the easiest man in the world to talk to.
He really said that?
He really did, said Alice. The three of them walking back across the square.
Well, I'll be,
said Cress, looking through his telescope on the terrace.
Jeb's come back, he said. Not surprised, said Evelyn. We all came back.
You staying with us for Christmas, Dottie? Said Ulysses.
I'll be here, Temps, scrubbing Dante next to my Swedish muse.
Music drifted in from the other room. It was Pete and his lament for Vietnam. People quieted to listen to Pete.
Christmas Eve saw the Pope giving midnight mass at the Duomo, but the gang from the Pensione weren't there. They were coming out for the cinema. Last episode of the Trilogia del Dollaro, The Good, the Bad and the Ugly.
That Ennio Morricone, said Massimo.
I think he's completely redefined the cinematic soundtrack, said Jem.
Ulysses and Pete laughing.
Made for each other, whispered Cress.
A slow nocturnal wander across the river, the water black and tame and the lights of the city pulsing quietly on the glassy surface.
Happy, Linny? Evelyn nodded.
You?
Nowhere I'd rather be.
A late supper at the newly reopened Michele's. Nina Simone on the jukebox and a photograph of Des' pride of place on the wall above the coffee machine. Biciclette all round and 8 for spaghetti alla vongole, if you please. The basilica emptied out and crowds gathered in the square for the Christmas hour. Alice walking back across the stones with her guitar.
Like old times, said Julia, and her hand brushed against Ulysses. Faint. But still that flicker.
The first anniversary of the flood brought everyone back as promised. Even Des returned with Poppy.
Some of the best days of my life, he said.
And wouldn't they all say that in time? The shared loss became the shared bond. Thousands walked down from the church of San Miniato al Monte to the Ponte alla Grazie in a candlelit procession. That was something, that was. By then it was known that in Florence, 33 people had lost their lives, 50,000 families their homes, 15,000 cars had been destroyed, 6,000 businesses lost, and the mighty shift of the working artisanal class had begun. The flood water had travelled at 40 miles an hour and had left behind 600,000 tons of mud, a ton for every citizen. 1,500 works of art had been destroyed or wrecked beyond repair, and a third of the National Library's collection damaged. It would take 20 years before restoration work on many of these items would be completed. Some would take longer. And the cause? Investigations into the massive release of water by both the Levain and La Pena dams resulted in shifting blame and would be a bone of contention for years. Lots of conspiracy sprang up in that unaccountable schism.
but everybody was questioning everything by then. Strikes and protests flared up across the country, and students occupied the universities. Goodbye, authoritarianism. Hello, civil rights. A new ideology was taking place, and the young left no stone unturned. Family, church, communism, fascism, you name it, they challenged it. Divorce and abortion were back on the agenda, and the Catholic right balked. On a lighter note, Michaelis acquired a piano. It used up the last of Des's money, but it was that or a billiard table, and Julia put her foot down, especially when she knew that Pete was staying for good.